personally found this a very useful way of looking at what is happening in meditation, and as a clarifying what mindfulness is really about in the first place. So this is in connection with the stage of integration. So the sutta is the Honeyball Sutta, the Mudu Pindala Sutta. It's Sutta, which one is it? It's from Majjhima Nikaya. It's Sutta 18, is that right? Honeyball Sutta. Yes, it's Sutta 18 from Majjhima Nikaya. It doesn't look right, but I think that is. It starts off with the Buddha being kind of confronted by a Brahmin, Drona the Brahmin, who asks him, "What do you teach?" And the Buddha, clearly recognizing this man as a combative and argumentative sort, says, "I teach how to be peaceful and harmonious," you could say. And the Brahmin is, you know, pretty sort of disgusted with that and goes off. So the monks ask the Buddha, "Well, what do you mean? How do you teach that?" And the Buddha gives a short exposition of how you achieve that sort of harmonious personality, as it were. And after the Buddha is gone, the monks all look at each other and say, "What did he mean?" And they turn to the Venerable Kachayana, who's famous for being for understanding the Buddha's deeper message, the famous Kachayanagata Sutta, which is supposed to be the foundation for the whole of the Majjhimaka. Nagarjuna mentions it in the Mula Majjhimaka Karakas. Kachayana gives a longer exposition of the sutta, explains what he meant. And what he gives is a nidana chain. So I'm not going to... The nidana chain is expounded in a somewhat complex form. The account that's given is not easy to disentangle. I've spent some time disentangling it, and I now will give you the fruit of my disentanglements. So you've got the Honeyball Sutta straightened out, no doubt with some of its subtleties missed. I won't go into as much detail as the Buddha goes into, but I'll give you the sort of pith of it. And then I hope that will help you in your work during the retreat, at least to get a framework for understanding what you're doing, and perhaps even a bit of a tool to work. So the Nidana chain begins, of course, with strife, taking up of sword, taking up of weapons, angry words, argumentation, quarrels, disputes, accusations, divisive tail burning, tail bearing, and false speech. So even extreme disharmony and argumentativeness and quarrelsomeness. And then the Buddha analyzes it back, or rather Kachayana shows the sequence that the Buddha, that this comes from. So I'm going to start from the other end, from where the chain begins. And it begins with sparsha. Vedana. And Samya. And then it, you could say they sort of come as a bundle, although they're sequential. And they move on to... change this chair. To the upper. Or Shloka in Sanskrit. That then gets caught up with underlying tendencies, anushaya. And it begins to spread out prapancha. The prapancha generates ideas, constructions. Construction is probably the best translation. Prapancha samya sankha. That then leads into a fresh cycle of Sparsha Vedana Samya. And that collides with the constructions of others and leads to trouble. So that's the cycle. So the whole thing starts with sparsha, which is, of course, contact. That's the coming together of the sense faculty with the appropriate object, contact between them. So the eye sense, the eye consciousness, comes in contact with something that's seeable, that produces an image. When we were doing the reflection, Satipatthana reflection, we started off with sensation, I called it, so that or the contact, so that you feel in your feet, you feel the sock, you can feel the contact of the sock with your foot, you can feel the contact of your foot with the ground, so you feel the external sensations, as it were. You can also feel the way I was putting it is energy in the foot. You may feel some tension, you can feel some muscular movement, or you may feel just energy freely moving in the foot. So that's the sparsha end of it. You can never completely sort out the sparsha and the vajana and the samya, because they come immediately bundled up together. It's I would say, a kind of biological thing. It's not, or rather a conditioned thing. It's to do with the three lower niyamas, with uttu, bija, and manu niyama. It just happens to you. Because you've got a certain body, you will have a certain set of sensations which will give rise to certain feelings, which will be packaged up as a complete experience. So yes, every sparsha, every sensation is accompanied by some degree of hedonic tone. The way which Buddhist psychology deals with this is by saying that there is always a hedonic tone, but sometimes that hedonic tone is neutral. In other words, you don't feel anything. Bhante, you remember, says that he thinks probably the reality is that there is a feeling there, but it's so minimal that you can't really sort of detect it, and other feelings are more dominant. So yes, there's contact through the body, through the senses, there's feeling that arises, and then there's the interpretation of that sensation and that feeling in terms of a situation. So what's being dealt with here is very, very basic. It's not highly sophisticated, it's not philosophical, it's not thought out in that sense. It's your primary identification of the world around you. So I call this, this is in my own terminology, not traditional one, it's primary experience.
Does that relate to the omnipresent mental events?
Yes, of course. Although only that these are the same elements. Yeah. So the Savastivada in Abhidhamma, which Yogacara inherited, instead of using the five skandhas, they use the five omnipresent mental events. But it's just basically the same cake cut slightly differently with different labels on it, stuck in the top, the toothpick. So this is ordinary experience, the world that we share because of our common evolutionary inheritance, you could say, because we've got the same bodies, the same sense organs, we have the same experiences, and of course we learn to label those experiences from a cultural point of view. So we see that as a table rather than as a dancing floor or as a piece of firewood or something like that. But you don't need to get too picky about that. It's your straightforward identification of the objects in your room, ceiling, floor, Sangha Ketu, the ability to it's the labelling of your world and your assembling of it into a comprehensible and organisable reality.
So
primary experience.
That you've labelled it. You've got a knowledge of.
Yeah. So that your senses deliver you raw sensations, you could say. Vedana comes packaged with those as a sort of like dislike, nice nasty pain, pleasure. And the samya sort of brings all that together and makes an intelligible whole of it. Yeah, this is all fairly familiar to you. But what we're dealing with here is something in a way that doesn't require a lot of questioning in a Buddhist context. Yes, you can analyse that, even in the sense of saying that the identification of the objects in your world is to some extent culturally bound, culturally specific. Well, the language that you use is going to be different, but the broad mapping of your experience is common to is more sort of biologically bound and based, although of course culture gives that a form and a language. So I wanted to stress this in a way. It's not sort of starting to argue that that reality needs to be questioned or anything like that. It's saying this is where you need to start. In a sense, what happens is that your primary experience has within it pleasure and pain. It's there at every moment. It's there in every situation. Every experience comes to you with some sort of tinge to it. Some of the tinge is sometimes so minimal that it doesn't really generate much charge, although that has an effect in itself, dullness. But obviously when it's painful, when it's a sufficiently strong pain, you want to remove it or get away from it, avoid it. And when it's pleasurable, of a sufficient quality of pain or quantity of pain, of pleasure, you want to continue in it, to perpetuate it and to regain it. So there's a sort of charge coming out of your experience. There's an implication in your experience which is generated from the Vedana. This is why in so much of Buddhist training, identifying clearly Vedana is very key. Vedana is, we know from the analysis of the wheel, is the changing point. It's where you have a choice, so to speak. So in this analysis, what happens then is that you begin to think about your experience. Samnya is just a pure identification, but you then begin to reflect on it. And your reflection on it is motivated by Vedana. Again, this is a absolutely basic Buddhist insight. In the Brahmajala Sutta, you know, all the views that come up, the 64 views that are traced in the Brahmajala Sutta, the Buddha traces back to feeling. They're all a response to feeling. Obviously, some of them are extremely sophisticated and complex, but they have their root in either a desire to perpetuate pleasure, regain pleasure, or to avoid pain. And well, we'll see that in some ways that the Buddha is arguing that the great proportion of human culture and activity, however sophisticated, however complex, is really generated by a response to this. So we begin to reflect, and obviously the faculty of reflection, vitarka, tarka is the modern Indian word, Hindi word for reasoning. Tarka shastra is logic, the study of logic. So it's the faculty of reasoning, or it is the act of reasoning. Vi is a word meaning division. So it's the faculty of dialectics, you could say. Although, of course, it's ordinary dialectics, not Socratic or anything like that. It's just thinking. You've got two things, you try to relate them. It's that sort of process. So you've got an experience, you've got a conundrum, you've got a puzzle, which is generated by the fact that you're in pain. And how do you get out of it? How do you avoid it? You've got pleasure, so how do you get back to it? How do you keep it going?
Is this where we move from the animal realm, which would be the first three, into
you could say that
self-conscious?
Yeah, you could say that
reason.
Yeah, that what human the human organism adds is a capacity to think in a more articulated in an abstract way about experience. With an animal, there's pure instinct. So the instinct is translated into an ability to reflect. But what then happens in most cases, is the reflection goes out of hand, and it spreads out. Prapancha is a word that there's a lot of difficulty in translating, but it means something like its root meaning is to spread out, and it means something like complexifying, complicating. So the thinking, whether unconsciously so or whether deliberately driven, it spreads out and it connects up with all sorts of other mental factors. It spreads out, it connects up with memory, other times when you've experienced this. It connects up with underlying tendencies, anushaya. That is, for instance, if you are, you've got a sort of a tendency to irritation and anger, that gets caught up in the reflection on the experience. Or if you've got a tendency to addiction or obsessional craving. That gets caught up with it. Or if you've got a tendency to deliberate ignoring as an act rather than as a lack of knowledge. You know, because moha in Dhamma is a kamma. It's not a description of a lack of knowledge. It's an actual act. I always want to illustrate this with a story told to me by a cousin who was a panorama interviewer. And he, after his BBC career was over, after he was become a great being in the BBC world, he interviewed some very, very interesting people. And amongst these was Albert Speer. I heard his interview, it's very, very interesting. And he said that he asked Albert Speer, you know, look, you weren't a Nazi, but you got mixed up with all this. He was a rather minor architect who got taken up by Hitler and propelled into enormous influence and building horribly bad buildings all over the place. Although the Nuremberg rally was something. So my cousin said, well, when did it start? What happened? Why did you allow yourself to get mixed up with all this? And he said, you know, he'd been alone for 30 years and had time to think about things. and he said, well, I know the precise moment. And he said it was when he was inducted into the ministry. He wasn't propaganda, was it? I can't remember what he was minister of. But he was brought into the ministry after the Night of the Long Knives. Do you remember when the socialist wing of the National Socialists was eliminated, you know, quite literally? And his predecessor had been on the socialist wing of the Nazi Party. And so he said he remembers walking into the ministerial office and being shown in by his flunkies, and out of the corner of his eye he noticed a stain on the carpet, and he said he knew immediately what it was. It was the blood of his predecessor, and he knew he's aware that he deliberately didn't take it in. He deliberately moved his mind away from that experience. So it's a very powerful, rather horrible story, although it quite admirable in a way that he was able to dredge that up and willing to say it. But that, to me, that's the epitome of ignorance. It's where you you deliberately turn your mind away from an unpleasant moral truth about yourself. So quite important, I think, to give this content to moha, not to just think of it as, oh dear, nobody told me. Of course, that's how one would justify it. But, you know, in your heart of hearts, you know that you knew.
What comes to mind is mindset. It's a bit like it's got very complicated, but then you have this mindset where you then just fall into what's there and stay with it. Like it's stuck, just stuck into a mould.
So yeah, the thinking gets mixed up with pre-existing trends and tendencies, and especially undischarged energies. You've got irritable. Your wife nagged you, so you kick the cat. That sort of thing, where you displace energies through other activities. So these sort of very deep underlying tendencies, which go right down into the depths of the mind, right down to the anushayas, are equivalent to the ashravas, but they have layers within the mind. And that all gets mixed up with this response to an attempt to deal with pleasure and pain. And it just gets out of hand. It just spreads out. And one of the reasons why I found this account so compelling is that happens to me, at least all the time in meditation. Your mind, something comes into your mind under the law of karma, you know, previous experience is re-triggered, and then you start to dwell upon it, and it starts to spread out, and everything gets linked up with it, everything gets caught up with it.
Including the process of reification, you know, sort of justifying intellectually all the things that you want.
And so it builds this, to begin with, at this stage, it's in process. It's being sort of, and another thing, what it then does is build into a system. Prapancha Sanya Sankha. So Sankha means adding together. Sanya means knowing together. So assembling or constructing. An assemblage or construction of that prapancha, of that complexity.
So that's a compound term.
There you are. There's the hyphens.
What's the anusara?
That was the underlying tendencies I was talking about earlier. So it's sort of the spreading out tends to solidify and forms a kind of system. Sometimes that system is relatively short-lived. I'm most familiar with it thinking about somebody who I consider to be acting wrongly towards me. I start to explain their behaviour, and it forms up into a complete analysis of them and why they do that, which of course is independent of me, which is only the truth. But it has a sort of, you know, there's even the sort of sense of, that's what it is. Or it can be explaining a situation in which you've been humiliated or which you've been thwarted. You provide yourself with this complete explanation. It can be, of course, positive in a sense.
No, so sometimes I found from doing that, I just stop myself. It's like a fantasy. It's like I'm building this picture up.
Yeah.
It's unreal.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's easy to notice other people doing it, isn't it?
Yeah. Every now and again you catch yourself. On solitary retreat I found it really interesting. I would start thinking, you know, somebody would come into my mind remembering something nasty they'd done, and I start to dwell on that and you know, start to feel upset about it. Then I think about talking to them and saying something to them. Then I think about what they would say back. And then I get annoyed with what they would say back. And afterwards, wait a minute, that didn't happen.
It's quite strange.
It's embarrassing.
What does sankha mean again? Short
sankha. Kar is to add. Or you know, what's the word? Compute. It's literally compute. Com is the same as sun, and putari is to think, isn't it? So it's to think together, to pull together, to add together, add up. So the function, the prapancha spreads out, and the samyak sankar is the sort of drawing of a structure into that prapancha, so that it clunks. And it can be, as I say, sort of momentary or you know, relatively short-lived. It can be something that happens within a meditation, a single meditation, a single conversation. You know, particularly what happens often, you get together with somebody to talk about somebody else or a situation, and you form together a prapancha sanya sankha, which makes you feel okay. You've explained the bad behaviour, or you've justified your pursuit of further pleasure, or whatever it is.
You said it could be positive.
I didn't mean positive. I meant pleasant rather than painful, because what I was describing was to do with anger, but it can be to do with craving, and you know, p- pursuing pleasurable sensation.
But it can't be positive in a positive sense.
No.
No.
No. Sorry.
Very positive about this.
It could be positively negative, negatively positive, but it can't be positively
negative.
It means complexity or spread. Its root meaning.
So that's trapancha, isn't it?
Prapancha.
The one at the top.
Prapancha samya sankha. So it's the.
Oh, that's the same as below, is it, that word at the top?
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. That's why I've used the same letters.
Well, it seems a very natural function, though, to try and make sense of your feeling, your experience.
Yeah.
It's only when you go on to solidify it, informed by your tendencies, that it starts to go skew with.
Yeah.
But before that, it seems quite a reasonable.
Well, there's nothing wrong with vitakka.
Yeah.
The problem with vitakka is it gets out of control and it gets mixed up with anushaya. We're in the middle of an exposition of a Nidana chain which talks about the way in which we deal with our experience, and which we'll find in the end, I hope, is useful for our practice during this retreat.
Can I just ask something? You just said it can never be positive, that cycle. We're talking about ethically positive?
Yes, I think that's what women have to say, yeah.
At what point in that cycle does the ethical judgment enter? At vitakka?
Vitakka. I'll explain. I'm going to take you through it and then reel you back. Yeah. So just to recap, there's basic experience, sparsha, contact with the sense of the senses with their objects, vedana, which is the primary evaluation of that in terms of pleasant and painful, and samya, which is the assembling of the experience of the sense experience into an intelligible whole, in a very ordinary sense, table, chair, no, not chair, fan, etc. Sinaketu, Mogavamsa, etc. Which I'm referring to as primary experience. It's not a traditional term, but I find it helpful. Then you start to reflect upon that. You think about that because you've got a problem. You've got vedana. You want to keep the pleasant going or get back to it. And you want to avoid the pain or get away from it or avoid it in the future. So you start to reflect upon your experience. Problem is that gets out of hand and it starts to spread out. As prapancha means spread out. Complexify, what's the word? Complicate. It complicates. And it gets mixed up with underlying tendencies. Anusaya means underlying tendency. And it then forms into a whole. A prapancha samya is a sort of constructing, and sankha is adding up, computing even.
Growing all the time, isn't it, as you feed it?
Yeah. But all the time, you're both adding to it and you're making intelligible whole of it.
So is that Miccha Ditti?
Miccha Ditti's come out of this, yeah.
So the term ahankara comes to mind, the story we tell ourselves, where would that fit in?
Ahankara is what is in here, yeah. So there's a whole list of things that come out in this, according to the commentary. There's I am the thinker, being, not being, me, not me, mine, not mine, doer, done to, victim and perpetrator, powerful and impotent. Signifier, signified, that which is indicated, that which is not indicated. So there's a whole set of discriminations which are really circle around the idea of I. They're all sort of bound up with it, so it's good to mention that ahankara, which we dealt with a lot in Guhyalanka, didn't we? The mind maker, I maker. So it's all sort of clunked together around me. And then new experience, sparsha vedana samya, which is repeated from down here, is filtered through this construction. And of course that construction is not merely personal, it's cultural. So it's shared, it's cultural in the limited sense of family or you know, your group, and it's cultural in the larger sense of your particular, you know, set within the culture, white, middle class, whatever.
Ideology.
Because ideology, you inherit ideologies which help to explain your experience and which you then filter your experience through. So it's at this point it becomes collective. And it's also becomes embedded in, embodied in language. Language structure to some extent determines how you experience. And all new experience, yes, is filtered through this. And trouble comes because other people are doing the same thing and they come to equal and opposite or different conclusions. And then, well, depends on the strength of the clash and the intensity of the Vedanas underlying it all, but then you get really severe problems. As I said, I became aware of it, re-aware of this sutta, and aware of its significance that just earlier in January, when I was in Hungary, and our gypsy friends, our gypsy mitras and so forth, were very, very stirred up and worried because there's an extreme right-wing, well, no, not to put too fine a point upon it, fascist party which gained 35% of the votes in Soyokaza. And which has an explicitly anti-gypsy agenda. It's nicely disguised, but it's only thinly disguised. It makes the BNP look like pussycats. It started off anti-Jewish, but there are not enough Jews left in Hungary, and they're too powerful. They're embedded in the economic system too much. So the gypsies are much more easy target. So, you know, I was asked, well, kind of, what have you got to say about this? And I remembered this sutta, and I've always meant to try and sort of dig it out in a politically hot situation, so I did. And we looked at what happens to a member of Yopik, that is this right-wing party. I don't know whether you were aware of this at that time. Yeah. And a lot, I mean, a number of gypsies were murdered last year. And gypsies were blamed for the murder. Some gypsies were murdered.
Yeah.
And the other gypsies were blamed for the murder. But it later, you know, after a year, gypsies were in jail for a year, and it eventually emerged that it was people connected with this, skinheads, I suppose you'd call it. So people very, very worried and upset. And of course, they're doing the same. They're prapanchising all over the place. Like I was told while I was doing this, somebody said, told me that they'd heard that somebody working for the police department had heard that the police were going to support Yopik in burning down the school. So, you know, prapancha is streaming away. So we went through, we analysed what happens to a classic Yopik member. He's Hungary, you know, after the collapse of the wall, freedom comes, collapse of the economy, huge unemployment, inrush of especially German and other European Union businesses. Tesco's is the leading retailer in Hungary now, one of them anyway. So they're swamped with, you know, sort of access to Western material goods and knowledge about Western material goods. But the economy is wrecked, it's struggling, and it's been hit again with the recent economic crisis. Hungary was very, very badly affected by that. They got the vision of Tibor saying they thought they were going to be in Austria or Switzerland. within a few weeks of the wall coming down. And actually, in some ways, they're worse off than they were under the communists. Yes, they're freer, and they can watch whatever porn they want to, but no work for many of them. 90% of gypsies in northern Hungary are unemployed, and a lot of peasants, white peasants, are in really quite bad economic situation. So, experience of losing a job, worry, humiliation, national humiliation, because Hungary is a country that has been a loser for 400 years. It was independent, fully independent 400 years ago. Since then, Turks, Russians, Germans, Austrians, Romanians, the great powers at the end of the First World War. Hungary has just been the sort of football of Europe, right in the middle of Europe. Completely different ethnic and linguistic cultural family, and just squeezed by everybody else. So you're peasant, you're industrial worker, out of a job or worried about job, with vastly increased expectations and very strongly diminished self-esteem, very painful feelings. You've got to explain it. And a bit of a brutal sort of background, very coarse and crude culture, and not very refined. We won't go into that, the history of that. So you begin to sort of be looking for explanations, and you're offered an explanation which is has a nice history to it, which is to do with the best period of recent Hungarian history, when the Arrow Cross were in charge, Hungarian Nazi Party, when Hungary had some dignity and pride, and when the gendarmerie controlled the countryside and kept the gypsies under control. And you've got some echo of that under the communists. So all of that sort of your experience, your personal experience, is explained, and a way out of it, a way of first of all controlling the people who are really messing things up for you, the gypsies, and finding some pride and dignity and a future for yourself. It's all there in Jopik. So the Prapancha Samya Sankar is a sort of melding of your own complex reactions to, and to call them thoughts is probably to over dignify them, but mental processes with words attached to them, get mixed up with a nice clear explanation. And clunk. Every time you see a gypsy after that, you see an enemy. And the gypsy, of course, reacts to you with varying kinds of behaviour. I mean, a lot of the time my experience is that crowds of gypsies will get very, very boisterous in a public situation, which is a response to the way people are seeing them. So they get unruly as a or very great fear, which also can manifest as that sort of behaviour, which of course confirms the reaction of the other people. And you get violence, death, and a really stupid political party having a great deal of power. So the sequence, yes, it works on the macrocosmic scale. It can explain what goes on in society, but we here are not going to be having a lot of that sort of macrocosmic stuff going around us. Well, there will be some, of course, the irritating things that people do with washing up and things like that. But by and large, it's going to be more close up to us, and we've got a chance to see these processes going on. It's interesting, you were sort of talking about, in a way, the move from the animal into the human, and it's as if the human, what the human being adds to this can be simply a greater capacity for destruction, and destruction either in a in a warfare sense, or destruction in a greed sense. You know, in a way, the environmental problems that we have are the destruction that comes from excessive consumption, uncontrolled and ill-considered consumption, whereas terrorism, warfare are the destructions that come from hatred and fear and so on. So yes, but at the same time, the vitaka is the potential salvation. It's what can actually sort of get us out of this process, because the vitaka can redirect us to the primary experience and order our future action. So you could say that vitaka here has, vitarka in Sanskrit, has really, well, you could say four functions. The first function is to redirect us to primary experience. You could say that this is what I call secondary experience. It's even, in a way, a secondary reality. And I think it's very, you know, it's very interesting. We have this second life, don't we, on the web. Like a friend of ours fell in love with somebody in second life, and when she dumped him, he was heartbroken. We laugh, but there's a lot. I think technology, and especially the new information technology, gives us a power to construct experience that human beings have never had before. So secondary reality is increasingly real and compelling and sort of seductive. Very difficult to disbelieve that or really understand what's going on.
With this might just be about language, but primary experience, and what about things like primary concepts, like the ceiling and the floor?
Yeah.
Where does conceptualization fit with this? I mean, it might be kind of a concept of socialism as well.
Well, well, I suppose you could say the distinction where a spiral comes out of here rather than a circle is that in the cyclic function, instead of your samnya and vitaka are really quite close in a way. Instead of your conceptualizing your experience being merely a way of ordering it in a very basic sense, it becomes a way of it becomes a reaction to your experience. I don't know whether that makes it clear, but in other words, primary identification is simply learning how to add labels to your world and use your world for very basic survival purposes. But the spin that Vedanar gives to your vitaka is to produce a whole explanatory model which is fueled by Vedanar. Mm-hmm. I'm still not quite expressing it clearly enough, am I? But you're getting something of what I'm talking about. There's, in a way, samnya here is morally neutral. There's no not necessarily any value to it. Any moral value.
Is that just direct perception?
It's direct perception
without,
and the labelling.
Without the label.
Well, no, the labels are there.
Okay.
The label samnya is labelling.
Yeah. Okay.
But it's merely recognising. Mm-hmm. In of course.
It's not like a judgmental.
No. And of course it's problematic because some labelling is judgmental. In a way, when you label something, you're deciding that it's this and not that. And sometimes that can be closing off. This could be firewood. And if you were very cold, if you insisted on it being a table and wouldn't let it be a piece of firewood, that would be a problem. And of course, I'm not wanting to hide the epistemological issues in that, but at the same time, if you make a very broad kind of distinction between the mere function of recognizing what's there in an ordinary human sense, and the working up of those concepts through ratiocination into a theory about your experience. You remember all dittis from the Buddhist point of view are problems, except when those dittis direct you back to what really is there.
You seem to be preaching love and peace in quite a roundabout way.
That might be an outcome, but that might be a little trivial, if you see what I mean, as a way of putting it.
No, but the reason I said that is just that I suppose the underlying thing is that can people stop that circle without social justice?
Yeah. Without?
Without social justice, will they break that circle?
Yeah. Yeah. But let's stick with the theory of it. So, we were saying this is the sort of breaking point. Yeah, that was your what? So instead of vitakka spreading out in an uncontrolled and unconsciously driven way, vitakka takes you back to your primary experience. So this is vitakka, vichara, in meditation. In the first dhyana, there's still some vitakka vichara, you remember? So that's not a spreading out kind of ratiocination. What it's doing, where you're recognizing your reflection helps you to get deeper into the experience. So you're recognizing the elements of your experience that are helpful and those that are not helpful, or where to place your concentration. So you're for instance saying to yourself, well, look at the subtle aspects of the sensation of breathing. You're saying to yourself, allow that sense of enjoyment to increase. Maybe even sometimes you're saying, don't go there. So it's a reflection, but it's a reflection that draws you back into the primary experience.
And also reflects on itself, the vitaka reflecting on the vitaka process.
And in the end, the suttas say that at a certain point you think, why am I bothering to think? And the vitaka becomes, in a way, a certain sort of burden. So you want to let go of it, and it's a there is still a directive force, but it's no longer sort of conceptualized. It's more of a sensitivity and awareness rather than a thought process.
Can you give me an example of how that might evolve? You see something you like, and perhaps you think I shouldn't be liking that.
Okay.
And reassess it.
Well, as I said, I think that you could say that you use vitakka in four different ways. You use vitakka to direct you back to primary experience. In other words, the sort of reflection that we were doing this morning. What we were doing was trying to get more deeply into sparsha and vedana. So you use your vitakka to direct you back to mindfulness. To a basic mindfulness of your immediate sensations, your feelings, in the Satipatthana, the overall tone of your mind, and ultimately the nature of it, of your experience. So vitakka is the sort of directive principle. Then you use vitakka towards mindfulness. Then you use vitakka to look at what is skillful and what is not skillful, what is helpful and what is unhelpful. So vitakka then becomes ethics. So you'd be faced by a certain situation, you'd be faced by certain I was going to say choices, it's more like impulsions, things that you're drawn to or driven to, and you'd use your thinking process to apply the precepts to that experience, or to apply a precept-like analysis or exploration of that experience. So the precepts are one of the key ways in which you stop yourself zooming off, because they draw you back into this moment, or rather with this power, they draw you back into choosing the best thing to do in the situation. Often it's really important to first of all come back to your primary experience. If you find yourself zooming away, come back to body mindfulness. This is what the texts suggest, and probably ordinary experience suggests. Come back to what you're actually feeling, and then from that point of view you're more able to calmly reflect upon what's best to do. Your vitaka also draws you into learning to use your mind without prapancha, in other words, meditation, and especially jhanic meditation, because in jhanic meditation, what it's really about is stopping prapancha. Once you stop prapancha, your primary experience becomes more and more subtle. It doesn't become alienated from your experience. You stay with it, but you go more and more deeply into it in a more subtle, refined way. And that has the effect of training you in ceasing to prapanchize. Because prapancha is so habitual, and there's so much that encourages us, and we're constantly feeding the trend and tendency. So one of the functions of vitakka is to direct you to practices that where you dwell without prapancha.
Is prapancha always negative?
Yes.
So I mean, for instance, if you have an underlying tendency to go to hear a beautiful piece of music, and that music caused your conscience to spread out in a particular sort of way.
Well, of course, I mean, now we're equivocating on the word spread out, but here spread out means that you spread out to a lot of other thoughts which just form a sort of confirming pattern for your escape from the underlying Vedana. So if you mean by spread out, expand, I would contrast spread out with expand. If the effect of the music was to expand your mind, well, that's not prapancha. Yeah.
Wanted to understand more deeply vitaka. I'm wondering if it could be summarised as the intention to place your attention skillfully, something like that. Would that work? Or
well, that would be to analyse the process in a different way. Vitaka literally means thinking. So it's a thinking that has the function of bringing you back to your primary experience.
So thinking in the context of the Dharma, that is.
Yes.
As
yeah.
In discursive thinking,
yeah.
It's not.
Yeah. Well, so there's thinking that can take you into a spreading out, and there's thinking that takes you back into a deeper experience of what's going on, what's really going on, and which allows you to make choices that are more constructive, both for you and for others. Mm. And of course, there's a fourth kind of thinking, which is a thinking about aided by the categories of the Dhamma, thinking about the nature of your experience as impermanent, insubstantial, etc. So vitaka is a function that draws you back to what's really going on in the primary sense. It draws you, it allows you to bring in an ethical consideration to choose what's best to do. It allows you to train yourself to dwell without prapancha, and it brings to bear upon your experience a recognition of its real nature.
Of what?
Its real nature. In other words, prapancha, prajna.
So, Bruce, I'm just curious about this, the type of this is in thinking. I have two senses of that. One is thinking as in like quite a digital cerebral activity,
mm-hmm.
But also thinking is knowing, which is not about thinking up here like this. It's more quality of being. Maybe it's coming back to Samya. Quality of body, being, knowing.
Well, in the context of this particular Nidana chain, Vitarka here is a conceptualized reflection. But that conceptualized reflection doesn't need to be, as you put it, I can't remember the words you used, or cerebral or whatever.
Digital.
But, you know, the more you are in contact with your primary experience, the less that Vitarka will be of that somewhat alienated kind. And that's part of the problem, that the whole set of mental processes that ensue are increasingly alienated. That's why I've made this distinction between primary and secondary experience. This is alienated experience. You're alienated from experience. So the thinking takes you away.
So prapancha is not alienated?
Yeah, well, the first prapancha is, it's a process, if you see what I mean. Thinking gets more and more complex and draws in more and more elements, brings in more and more evidence, more and more memories, more and more you know, patterns that you've got from elsewhere, until it forms up into something that's got a certain sort of completeness and
justification.
Well, it seems self-justified. that's it, isn't it?
Because it can have valid elements in it, can't it?
Of course, yeah. Well, Bante quoted me the other day, Blake, saying that everything that a human can believe is an image of truth. So that, you know, there's some truth in it all. A little distant, you know, like Bante says, through the wrong end of a binoculars or whatever on a dark night. But there's some truth in there. But the way it's all assembled and the basic underlying motivation for it.
And of course, Blake also said mutual forgiveness of each other's vice opens the gates to paradise.
He said many things.
In a way, all of this is saying you could decide not to just give in to that negativity.
Yeah.
So let me just check something. Anusaya is unconditioned. Sorry, unconscious. Conditioning.
Yeah.
So it applies in the social world that you're describing. You defined it saying underlying tendencies. So it could be underlying tendencies within a culture, within a society.
Yeah. So for instance, in Hungarian society, there's clearly an underlying racist tendency, which was suppressed under the communists, and it's just come out again. Is that what you're getting at? Yeah.
There's context, it's kind of emotional, social, cultural context in which it's
Yeah, because you're spreading out, links up. Yeah. What the mind does is try to form a pattern that makes intelligible what's going on. It's very, very useful in the jungle when you're trying to get some fruit or an escape in an enemy or something like that. You need to work out what's going on. Or when you're trying to catch a mate, it's all very useful. But in a complex situation that we've developed as a result of this God-given whoops, an Anushaya podcast. it gets sort of it gets out of hand.
There's an implication that if you didn't bother with all that, or if you just returned to this, that would be enough. That you've got knowledge there, you've got experience and knowledge. So ideally, you would just stay there.
Well, the problem is that you're a human being, and you've got the capacity for this, which is the self-consciousness.
Yeah.
So if you don't find a way to be back here, which is completely satisfying, you'll be going off around there.
Yeah.
So it's not that you can just become an animal again.
No.
You can't just be satisfied with eating, drinking, and making merry.
Yeah.
Sounds good, but
But could there be a positive cycle around Sparsha Vedana Samya Vitaka back to Sparsha, staying within primary experience?
Yeah.
Presumably conditioned by Anisaya, because we don't really get much choice about them.
Of course, what happens with mindfulness, you stay close to your primary experience. So you stay in contact with what's actually happening. With ethics, you choose wisely what to do in ways that will not bring greater harm to you, and you know, make prapancha or mix prapancha up with a whole mass of other factors under the law of karma. With vitaka, you direct yourself to samadhi so that you learn to deepen primary experience. Because what samadhi does is it brings richness and depth to primary experience. You could say culture is culture in the higher sense. So you could see that samadhi is part of that. So it's bringing the imagination into play. So that because primary experience isn't just it's this amplified, explored in depth. It's full richness brought out of it, which is what you know happens in the best of human culture through art, literature, the best of human thinking, and of course through the best of spiritual tradition and spiritual practice. It brings you're staying with primary experience, but that primary experience is enriched. I think that's the best way to think of it. Because sometimes when you hear mindfulness talked about, it's a bit like, yeah, you're just sort of a boring kind of just being here now kind of thing without. But actually, what happens when you stay with your primary experience as a human being, that primary experience enriches, it deepens, and it also gains more and more meaning. Meaning comes into that primary experience. So you don't go into a secondary experience. You find more and more richness in primary experience and more depth of meaning in primary experience. So vitaka, I think this is what's so interesting about this model. I don't know of any other Buddhist context where thinking, even, you know, needs to be amplified. It's not just kind of a computer thinking. It's a human being thinking. But reflection upon your experience is so valued. Reflection upon your experience is the key, in a way. It's what stops you from whizzing around there. Because as a human being, you can't help but to use that capacity for conceptualization to deal with your experience.
Mm-hmm. So what about the amplified bit, think like how culture, education, philosophy, that whole, because we are...
Yeah.
We talk to each other, we learn all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you learn without, you know, disappearing into prapancha?
Yeah. Well, of course, that we learn in culture, we learn some useful tools, some useful basic tools like language and so forth, and how to get on a bus. But we also learn attitudes from the culture, don't we? What we need to do is to sort of re-acculturate ourselves, and that's what we try to do in the context of Sangha. We try to create a culture that helps us to deepen our and enrich our primary experience, and to invest that primary experience with more and more meaning. So yes, culture can, if you like, yes, I suppose that's interesting, isn't it, that you could sort of say that the prapanchic cycle mixes up our out of control Vedana with cultural patterns that are unhelpful to us and unhelpful to others. But there can be a cultural a culture, which is Sangha at its best, which draws us back into primary experience, that brings us back to what actually is going on. Does that?
Could we say something there, actually? We are talking about vitaka, no? But is that we can come to the primary experience when will you more ethically live, get your life? I mean, is that is possible that? Because
yeah.
the difficulty is that we are having the tendencies under
yeah.
that is so
yeah.
thick,
yeah.
or maybe
yeah.
so much, that though we discuss so many things, but
yeah.
it's not easy for us
yeah.
to go to the primary extent.
Yes. Yeah.
Instead, we tend to go to the
yeah.
anusaya or maybe prapanchayati
yeah.
all these things.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, is that makes difference if we live
yeah.
Skillfully or
yeah.
maybe ethically
yeah.
more richer and
yeah.
I mean, doing the activities which
yeah.
will help us
yeah.
to digest more or to close
yeah.
towards the primary experience
yeah.
instead of going that side. Though sometimes we may
yeah.
go that side.
Yeah.
But still,
yeah.
we come to that
yeah.
again to the primary experience so that you it helps you to become more what is alive or more positive or more changing within yourself.
Yeah.
Is that is helpful?
Yeah, 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 yeah. So you can have a culture that
yeah.
A new society
yeah, yeah,
that
yeah.
brings you back
mm.
to what's really going on and helps you to deepen and enrich that and
mm.
to invest it with greater meaning.
Mm.
And the problem is that we kind of want to do that,
mm.
but we also are habituated
mm.
to doing that,
mm.
and things around us reinforce that.
I mean, sometimes we know very good language actually.
Yeah.
We sometimes see things, something though we say this primary, but we don't want to do that. So just
yeah.
only use the language to say
yeah.
yes, I'm doing that sort
yeah,
of
yeah.
thing, but we are not.
Yeah.
Doing.
Yeah.
We are not changing
yeah.
within.
Yeah.
So that is a when sometimes. Yes, we
mm.
are very good in explaining
mm.
dharma in
mm.
a very better way.
Mm.
You know, in this literature, but in fact, we don't change
mm.
within us.
Mm.
So that is, I mean,
mm.
sometimes it's not
mm.
good, very good, isn't it? Yeah.
Mm.
Mm.
For the classic tradition, great emphasis is placed on knowing what's going on down here. Because it's here that the project is launched. You know, you said we don't want to.
Mm.
We want to go here
mm.
because we're unconscious of the motivations
yeah,
that are,
yeah, yeah.
Are habituated
mm.
into
mm.
us.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
Mm.
Seeing it in a more kind of political way, you're dealing with other people and
yeah.
other ideologies all the time, living
yeah.
in the secondary experience.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
So understanding this.
Yeah.
Actually, it's a way of dealing with the second, isn't it? So
yeah.
If you,
yeah.
Particularly as what you were saying earlier, that every one of them has at least an aspect of truth in their ideology,
yeah.
their worldview
yeah.
and everything. So
yeah.
if you acknowledge that and
mm.
be sympathetic to it,
mm.
I can see why you're like this. You
mm.
know, I can see where you come from. So.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, you are hungry, you are poor, you
yeah.
are, you know,
yeah, that's not the way to deal with it. Yeah,
yeah, you are a Roman Catholic or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah. But I think it does also give us a way of thinking about our collective project,
yeah.
both in relation to what we try to build up between us and among us, and in our relationship to the wider society. Now, thinking of the Buddha and the incident at Rohini, you know, the dispute, where the Buddha says to the two warring parties, which is more valuable, monks, warriors or water?
Yeah.
And he sort of defuses the situation because they got right up in here. So he brings them back to that I think is what
yeah.
he's doing. So Bhante talks about that, the decay of the notion of objective truth. And that's what he's getting at, that in a way vitarka is about objective truth,
mm.
is directing us back to that.
So that's what you mean by alienated and secondary?
Yes, yes. yeah,
so
yeah. yeah. You know, when people are facing each other across a river with spears in their hands, they're not really in contact with what's going on.
But sometimes
mm.
we don't want to, I mean, we
yeah.
in our contact actually.
Yeah.
Because the underlying tendency is so thick.
Yeah.
We take pleasure
yeah.
in secondary pain,
yeah.
secondary experience,
yeah.
rather than changing ourselves.
Mm.
It needs a
mm.
lot of efforts.
Yeah.
It needs a lot of commitment to do that.
Yeah.
Sometimes we say, oh, I can't change it, I
yeah.
can't do it.
Yeah.
So better to just
mm.
go to the situation
mm.
to the other one.
Mm.
So that is also possible.
Mm. Mm.
So I'm just wondering if you might share how you, I mean, this might be a bit much to ask you here, or if you'd respond, how you might yourself personally work in Vitaka, in prime experience, to bring it, to move it more towards Samyana rather than Prapancha. What would be your, let's say if you're sitting in meditation or you're sitting quietly somewhere and you notice all this stuff starting to go on, how do you work with it?
Well, I think the first thing is that I find it very helpful to have a model that sort of explains what's going on when it gets out of control. So I can identify, this is Prapancha. So that in a way you're naming, you're speaking objective truth. Whereas what's happened is you get caught up within the structure of your own alienated ratiocination. So that would be the first thing I'd say, that I try to catch myself and name what's going on. And then I try to come back to Sparsha and Vedana. I've felt more and more that a stronger emphasis on Kayanupassana, mindfulness of the body, is a key for me, and I suspect for most people. Tradition says that not everybody needs to start there. Some people need to start in other places with the Satipatthana, but my impression is so far that most people need to start with Kayanupassana. In other words, basic contact, and that the feeling that goes with that, pleasant or painful feelings in the body. Very difficult to be more subtly aware when you haven't got that. So I'd say when I find myself off up there, I try to notice it and to label it, and then to direct myself back to Sparsha and Vedana. If it's not in meditation, if it's in action, I would try to come back to immediate sensation and try to bring the precepts to mind. So, you know, there's obviously a lot more one could say, but yeah, it seems to me that this is why it's so important to have a very strong grounding in mindfulness of the body, because it's a way of getting yourself onto the ground, and then you can begin to act skillfully in relation to whatever it is that you're dealing with. If you're dealing, if you're a poor Hungarian peasant, you've got to deal with that situation. So you've got to find a more skillful way of dealing with it, a more constructive way of dealing with it. If you're a poor gypsy who's being oppressed, you've got to find a way of dealing with it that is creative, and so on. If you're a Dalit in India, you've got to find a way of dealing with that actually does take you forward and creates a good situation for as many as possible. But you need to come back to what actually is going on, and the thing that we know really is going on is our bodily sensation and our responses to our Vedana responses to that.
Would you go as far as saying that you can learn from your body? You mentioned undischarged energies before, and that there is this sort of idea that you can focus on parts of the body and they might be indicating some.
I've no real experience of that. I wouldn't say that it wasn't possible. Mm. I might choose to speak about it in a slightly different way.
Yeah.
Yes, I think sometimes the sort of language, it's a little bit about at the moment, isn't it, the wisdom of the body. I don't find that very attractive, and in fact I find it a little confusing, because I think often, well, the body also contains lots and lots of instincts, and if you to put it that way, so I think sometimes people are sort of justifying instincts, and I think the whole thing is rewarded by more complex analysis. So I wouldn't like to deny that what people are talking about might be something useful, but I don't have any experience of it. It's certainly not a traditional way of speaking.
Personally, I found in my limited understanding of the Dharma in conceptual terms, I found this area a bit limiting in terms of my own getting to understand not just understand up here, but understand at a deeper level what has been going on for me, certainly in the past, because I've had to work some very difficult stuff, which has been both a blessing and a curse, actually, because it's forced me to go in and really pay attention to things which are quite subtle. And I found it has required me to learn a new language within me. And it's not always about words, it's something else. And I just thought I'd throw it in because I think it can be quite subtle, actually. And when you say, you know, the wisdom of the body, I think there is a wisdom of the body, but I think you need to clarify what.
Well, it's a metaphor, isn't it?
Yeah,
so you'd have to really be careful how you use that metaphor.
Yeah, yeah.
Every metaphor has a back and a front.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So who was it said all theories are based in desire?
Sorry?
All theories are based
in
desire.
Well, that certainly is the what the Brahmajala Sutta is saying.
That
yeah.
Is it, yeah.
Yeah.
That's where it comes from.
Yeah.
And this is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. It's probably enough for now. Mm.
When are we going to silence the Buddha? Is there any take on that?
We'll see.
Okay.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. 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 Bit by bit.
I was wondering if we
were going to start. But we will, I'm sure. Yeah. Anyway, I hope that's helpful.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sort of giving you it because it's part of the, as it were, theoretical framework from which I'm coming in this retreat. Any part of it. And it's particularly to do with, to me, the business of the stage of integration. The stage of integration is really to do with learning to stay more closely related to primary experience. Because prapancha is disintegration. Even though that disintegration can be extremely focused. Do you know what I mean? You can be extremely sort of powerful and focused from up here.
Because it's a problem in meditation as well, a lot of people have, don't they? They're actually experiencing themselves up in secondary experience and they never get down to their primary experience.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that's one of the reasons why there's a greater need to emphasize being aware
physical,
of what
yeah,
a physical awareness. Mm.
It seems that the aesthetic has no role in the propunction, right? Is it? For an artist, whatever, it's always going back to primary experience and feeling it more sensitively.
Oh, yeah. That's the enriching of it that I talked of, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But am I right in saying it doesn't go the other way?
Well,
either,
of course.
Only, you know, kind of.
You've got a simple model here which makes two things, but what you get is that there is some deepening and sensitizing of primary experience, but it's then worked into a secondary experience.
Uh-huh.
So you could say that in some ways is what happens with much religion. This is the Brahmajala Sutta's point of view, that people have real experiences of a more subtle kind, but they prapanchize that experience. So something like 60% of the views in the Brahmajala Sutta are based on meditation experience or remembered post-mortem or pre-mortem, pre-life experience.
Pre-what?
But from before life, so that you remember how you were in a previous life
yeah.
and you think about life from that point of view. So you create a theory on the basis of experiences that you've had. Do you see what I mean?
Well, I'm not sure what the conclusion you draw from that is.
Well, I'm saying that there is a genuine experience of something higher or more subtle. So, for instance, you experience a very, very lofty state indeed, and you feel you're in contact with some vast energy or force or whatever.
Mm.
And so you give that the name God. And then you start to construct a whole theology, which is to do with how God relates to you and to mankind, and before you know it, you're on a cross, dancing with the thieves. And so, do you see what I mean? Or you're an artist and you have some very subtle, sensitive experience, but you place that within a context of interpretation that is, you know, means, for instance, that you think that you need to go to excess to have that experience, you have to drink a lot or whatever.
So all the positive nirvanas plan the experience, just going deeper.
Yes. Yeah. So yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Their primary experience, as I put it, enriched, and with meaning discovered within them. Yeah. So in this is a very major theme of the discussions I had with Bhante, that we need to be careful that the Buddhist doctrine that we use doesn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So ideas like shunyata, the ideas like the absolute,
mm-hmm.
can easily become propunchized
mm-hmm.
systems that then alienate us from primary experience.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's one of the becoming ideas of this ending up in the secondary experience. You could end up over-identifying
yeah.
it in a literal sense,
yeah.
and then off you
yeah.
go. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's more difficult with what Bhante is saying is that there's a difference between the primary descriptions of the Dhamma, which are contained in a Nidana chain like this, and theories about the nature of things, if you see what I mean. So that what Bhante is saying is that Pratitya-samuppada and its various accounts, although of course they are conceptualized, but they remain very close to primary experience. And the problem is when you create from that an abstract idea, which you then take for a reality.
It'd be too simple to say your primary experience is the muse.
The muse.
And then this which is the artist, the muse being that he or she can take it up into the secondary experience, and at least for a while create beautiful works of art. But if they lose contact with their primary experience,
I was using a different model to describe what happens. It's more that the artist goes deeper into the primary experience, or higher into the primary experience, whichever way you like to put it, so that the experience will be of a much more enriched sparsha. A much more subtle Vedana. The problem is that then gets theorized, conceptualized. It may be not a worked out theory, but sort of a system which alienates from the primary experience. So for it, it's easier to talk about it in terms of mystical experience in a religious context. So you have a mystical experience, which I would say was not moving away from primary experience, but a going deeper into primary experience, or higher into primary experience, whichever way you like to go. But then you impose upon that, you impose upon that a structure of thought that subtly reifies and therefore negates it.
It's sort of the answer to the age-old question, you know, can Christian or Muslim
yeah.
gain enlightenment? You know,
yeah.
Why can't they, you know?
Yeah.
Is there a sense in which we can step back from primary experience in order to reflect upon it in secondary experience, but that be a positive experience that then enriches primary experience, that you knowingly, instrumentally step out of primary experience, as we have for the last hour and a half, into secondary experience with the purpose of that?
Well, I think you could say that's vitarka, isn't it? If what vitarka, this is thinking, as we're discussing, of course it's not merely words, one's also experiencing and all, you know, looking at, consulting one's experience as one talks, but the effect of vitarka in a positive way should be to constantly direct you back and enlarge and enrich your experience of primary reality. So in a way, vitarka is a sort of step outside. The issue is not letting it go any further than that. But you're right. We're talking in abstractions, but those abstractions hopefully are going back into our experience, so that while we're talking, we're sort of consulting our experience, primary experience. The problem comes, and you can see it happen in a discussion, can't you? When it just floats off into people getting excited about ideas and not reflecting those ideas back. I think it's a bit what you were talking about, that we can talk about the Dhamma, we can have wonderful discussions about the Dhamma.
You're suggesting that vitaka is an integrated aspect of the primary experience. It's an integrated.
That's
an intimate part of.
That's why it's possible to have vitaka in first jhana. So our Buddhist discussions, our study groups, and our reflections should be as close to jhana as possible, ideally. In other words, that all the time you're speaking, you're sort of in contact with yourself, and you're in contact with, well, the other people around you, and you're sort of reflecting back into yourself, into the situation. It's a very useful articulation, that, of what should be happening.
What happens when you're in second jhana and feel that you're just in primary experience?
Well, in this deepened and enriched sense. And there is a directive force there, but it's not exactly conceptual. It's maybe related to what you're talking about. So you sort of know what you're doing, but there aren't words passing through your mind saying, oh, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. Because then you're in by definition, in first jhana. But it's not that there's sort of a reflection going on, but it's very much more intimately connected with the experience. And of course, what you once you've got yourself pretty soaked in that, you bring in some reflection of a pragmatic kind. Anyway, I think that's probably enough propunchizing for the time being.
Thank you.
Yeah, but I hope that's useful. At least gives you some tools to.
What set is this from?
Honeyball Sutta. Majjhima Nikaya 18, Madhupinda.
Would there be a reference to this somewhere where we could get hold of it?
Well, if anybody's interested in a very, very good, very scholarly exploration of the sutta, it's called Concept and Reality by Nyanananda. It's in one of those cheap Buddhist Publication Society's publications. I think it's one of the best modern Buddhist books around. It's very scholarly and very sort of philological, but he's clearly a man with real spiritual experience and concern. So he's teasing out the meaning of prapancha.
What's the name?
Concept and Reality by Nyanananda. NANA. It might be in the bookshop here. It should be. I've got a copy with me if anybody wants to look at it.
There's some reference in the New Mitra course, the module, the Transcending Views. What's his name?
Nyanaketi,
he's referring to this.
Great to have that available on the retreat. I've got to deepen my.
The sutta itself, as I said, I think you weren't here when I said it, it's a little opaque. So what you've got from me is my taking out of it. Whether it's actually there in the sutra or not, I think it's true.
Depends what you bring to the sutra,
isn't it? the culture I come from. Anyway, let's stop. Good.
Thanks very much. Yeah.